The Forgotten Soldier, Disc 6, Chapter 39. Sitting just inside the entrance to the Palace of Knossos, an ancient archaeological site detailing Minoan life on Crete, Guy kept his eyes on the ticket booth, waiting on his target to show. He glanced at his watch and saw it was nearly 5 p.m., the time the tourist destination closed, and wondered if he'd put too much trust in the email. Maybe his actions last night had somehow altered the instructions the second man had received. Did they know his phone was compromised? Had they decided to change venues? Did they understand that the man who owned that handset was now dead? It was a question he couldn't answer, and so he sat, waiting, watching, regretting letting the other man out of his sight. He consoled himself by thinking about the ferry ride. He would link up with the target there, whether he showed here or not. Worst case, he would miss a piece of the puzzle, but he hadn't lost the target. He brushed off one more vendor looking to sell him bottled water or a postcard, glaring at the woman hard enough to make her scurry away. Or maybe it was just his appearance, a 3-day growth of beard, no sleep, and the devil slithering through his soul. He'd spent the better part of 6 hours interrogating Nasser, the subject answering all questions unhesitatingly. Nasser told him he'd passed identification and money to the man he'd met, that the identification had come from a safe deposit box owned by the Qatar Investment Authority, and that the man was up to no good. But he didn't learn what that might be. Nasser didn't know, of that he was sure. During the interrogation and between Guy's sessions of vomiting at what he was doing, the only break the subject received, Nasser would have made something up if he was smart enough. He was not. Eventually, Guy turned to the table again, picking up the cell phone. Nasser gave up the passwords, scared of what Guy would find, but more afraid of the repercussions if he remained mute. Guy had searched it, seeing justification for his actions. He waded through names, text messages, and PDF files, laboriously using Google Translate, only to find all detailing normal activity. Then he'd come across a Word document held on a service called Dropbox. When Google Translate finished, he saw it was a damn after-action review of his brother's killing in Afghanistan, a triumphant discussion of slaughtering the infidels and the quest for jihad. And then a new email message appeared about a meeting tomorrow. He'd grown angry at that point, losing his objectivity and his nausea. He demanded answers for the email, but Nasser refused to tell him, or didn't know. After the destruction was wrought, Guy was betting on the second reason. When he felt he'd gathered all he could, Guy had dragged Nasser to the shower, still in his chair cocoon, placing his head near the drain, a gag in his mouth. Nasser had begged, thrashing in the tape. Guy had placed the barrel of his suppressed pistol up to the temple, saw the rolling eyes, tears streaming down, and couldn't do it. Not with the man looking at him. Key West had been different. There, the man had fought, pulling a knife and coming close to gaining the upper hand. The rage had been flowing, and it was almost self-defense. Man on man, with Guy gaining the win. Nothing like this. Nasser had no fight in him and was completely defenseless. Guy had knocked him out at that point, hammering his temple with the barrel, getting the eyes off of him, and then had pulled the trigger. Afterwards, he had distractedly turned on the shower, strangely feeling that it wouldn't be right for the maids to be forced to clean up the blood after it had solidified. He'd watched the red water swirl down the drain, feeling his soul going with it. He then curled up on the bed in the fetal position, trying to sleep. Way past midnight, staring at the ceiling fan in a half-sleep, he heard Nasser speak, asking for help. He'd snapped awake, sweat dripping down his back, straining his ears. He heard it again. He leapt out of bed, running to the bathroom and flipping on the lights. Nasser lay on the chipped tile, a gaping hole in his temple, his eyes unseeing. Guy began to believe he was losing his grasp on reality. He packed what little he'd brought and went outside, leaving the "Privacy Please" sign on the door. He'd rented the room for 3 nights, hoping nobody would check the room until he was gone. But if Nasser kept begging for help, the maids would hear. The thought made him giddy and confused. Losing it. He slept on a makeshift bench built by workers at a construction site next door. When dawn broke, he'd awakened, retrieved his scooter, and began to watch. At 0900, Guy saw a cab pull up to the hotel, a spike given the small size of the town and the absolute absence of a taxi business. Someone had called him. At 0910, the target exited the hotel, his face now shorn clean, getting into the back of the cab. At 0912, the cab drove away, winding through the small roads of the town, heading back to the main highway. Guy followed, glad to drive away from the voice inside the room, glad to distance himself from his sin. He followed, straining to keep up with the cab, his mind not on his task, but on the ghost in the hotel room, wondering if it would remain or follow him. They went back into Heraklion, the target stopping at the ferry terminal. Guy watched him from a distance, then let the cab leave, going to the terminal himself. With 200 euros, he learned the man was leaving tonight and purchased a ticket himself. He then jumped back on his scooter and headed to the Palace of Knossos, the destination in the email. The meeting was set for 4:30 in the afternoon, but so far the man hadn't shown. He watched a school group getting berated for not behaving properly, then the entrance of a family, two kids whining and the parents dragging them along, demanding that the trip to Crete become a learning experience instead of the vacation it should have been. He took a swig out of a bottle of water and saw a cab pull up. He lowered the bottle and saw his target exit. He patiently waited. The target entered, and Guy let him get deep inside, staring at a map under a glass shield. Planning for his contact. Guy snapped a couple of shots with his little digital camera and waited. The target moved up the path toward the ruins, and Guy followed. For the average tourist, Guy figured it took about an hour to see everything in the ruins. More if you had a tour guide blathering on. Guy started the chronograph on his Timex, both to keep track of his potential heat state and to determine a pattern of life for these types of meetings with the target. He needn't have bothered. Guy's target did a quick lap, moving amongst the trees and paths that surrounded the ruins, then stopped at a display of giant urns, just standing and waiting. Above him and to the right, behind an ancient mural, Guy held his breath and readied his camera. Nothing happened. Guy saw him check his own watch, then continue on, nonchalantly circling back to the parking lot. Guy saw the signs and realized the meeting was busted. He had no idea why, but knew with the man headed back to the entrance, there would be no link-up. So intent was he on the target that he failed to see the female tourist shadowing them the entire way. Guy couldn't be faulted for this. He'd kept a wary eye out for a threat and had found none. After all, there were plenty of tourists in the park, each taking pictures, so the woman didn't spike. but he failed to notice that the woman included him in every frame. Chapter 40. Khalid heard Nikos's phone ding and looked up. Nikos manipulated an application, then smiled. Khalid said, "He's here? We have contact?" Nikos held up his phone, saying, "Yes, he's on your man. You were right." Khalid crowded forward, saying, "What's he look like?" Nikos pointed him out, and Khalid said, "Good. Good. My man will be back in the city as his next stop. Are your men ready?" "Yes. But there's still the matter of payment." Khalid waved his arm, showcasing the opulence of the yacht stateroom, and saying, "Does it look like we're lacking in money?" Nikos said, "No, this boat is definitely a benefit. I appreciate not having to pay for a hotel room. But it's not a question of you being able to pay. There is the matter of how much. This man came to me from a contact in the United States government. I have to assume he has some connection with them, which raises the price considerably." "You were going to capture him for free in Athens." "Yes, yes, I was, but that was to protect our interests. That transaction is complete, and apparently my interdiction prevented whatever he had planned." Khalid focused on the Heraklion harbor for a moment, then said, "It did not. Why do you want him so bad?" "He has information we need, and he's harmed two friends of mine." "We will pay whatever you ask," Nikos said. "The price will be high, I promise. I'll have to disappear for some time, and I don't like living in caves." Irritably, Khalid said, "I just told you we would pay. I'm more worried that you can accomplish the task. You failed before." Nikos smiled and said, "There is a major difference reacting to a surprise and laying a trap. We won't fail. He comes to us alive. He's no good dead. So you keep saying, don't worry. If your man leads him to the cafe, my men will do the rest." "How?" "You pay, I deliver. My operational methods are none of your concern. Maybe in the past, but not here. My money brings me information. The cafe concerns me. Too many people. I won't tolerate another failure, and I won't pay unless I'm sure this has a chance of succeeding. Non-negotiable." Nikos considered, then said, "Okay, but the price just went higher. Maybe I'll retire permanently." "Fine. How are you getting him from the heart of the tourist area to here? Do you own the police?"
"No, but I do own the manager of the cafe. When your target arrives, he will be served by one of my men. The drink, water, coke, beer, whatever, will be spiked.
I don't want him unconscious. We only have the sail back to the mainland to talk, and I intend to leave his body in the middle of the Mediterranean. Anyway, how are you going to carry him from there to here?"
"The drug only makes him lose motor control. He can walk, but he can't fight. We usually use it for other reasons. The bathroom for the cafe is down a set of stairs right next to the delivery entrance. It's boxed in."
Nikos put a cigarette in his lips, lighting it.
"When he goes to the bathroom for a piss, and he will, a side effect of the drug, We'll simply roll him up and bundle him out the service entrance. He'll be here in minutes.
Nikos blew out the smoke and said,
All you have to do is have your man stay long enough for the drug to take effect.
How long?
15 minutes, 20 on the outside.
What if he fights?
Nikos laughed. He can try. It won't help him. Trust me. I've seen women try to fight. At most, they mumble a little bit, then do what they're told.
Khalid said,
You sold him a weapon. He won't have to strike you with a fist. Won't matter. The weapon will be hidden. He's not going to go to the bathroom waving it about. When we get on him, it'll be too late.
Khalid nodded, saying, All repercussions are yours if it goes bad. Until he's on this boat, we have no association or responsibility. That's part of the agreement.
Nico smirked and said, You have no faith.
Khalid glared at him and said, I have an abundance of faith. So does this man. He is not a teenage girl. He's a killer.
And you would do well to remember that.
Chapter 41 Guy stayed behind the cab, wondering what the entire trip to Knossos had been about. Thinking through the implications, once again wondering if his interdiction had something to do with the missed meeting. Clearly, the target was supposed to do some coordination at the ruins with someone other than Nasser. But that meeting had not occurred. Why? Was it because Nasser hadn't responded? But the email had stated no response was necessary. Greater still, why meet in a beach town? Then plan another meeting later at a tourist location inland. Nasser had passed the bank bag full of money and identification documents and given instructions. He was the man on the ground. So why the second meeting? It was poor operational security and poor planning. It made no sense. Then again, not a whole lot made sense when dissecting terrorist actions. Guy knew he was only seeing a piece of the pie. It was like reading a text message with a bad autocorrect. You stared at it, wondering what the hell it meant, but only because you were missing a letter that would make it clear. The cab stopped next to a short stone tunnel known as Arsenali Nuovi. It sat adjacent to the Heraklion harbor, a wonder from Venetian times falling into disrepair. The target exited the cab, walking into the arch, and Guy whipped his little scooter around, parking on the sidewalk next to two others. He made a show of locking up the bike, even though he had no chain, fussing around and letting the target exit the tunnel, getting on to his destination. The man eventually did, walking up 25 Augusto Street, just as Nasser had before. The pedestrian thoroughfare is clogged with visitors, as it had been on that first day. Guy was convinced he was heading to the Alpha Bank. Guy fell in behind, keeping a few tourists between them, thinking of how he could penetrate the bank with the target. He'd declined to risk it before. But then the mission had been simply to kill Nasser. Now he wanted to decipher whatever plot was occurring. Begging for it to be something evil, something that would prove he was on the side of the righteous. To his surprise, the target passed right by the bank, not even giving it a glance, continuing up the street. Eventually, he stopped at a cafe called Central Park, staring at the menu for a moment, then wandered inside. Guy followed. The cafe was split half in and half out, with the outside area sprawling haphazardly next to a park. The patio, covered by large individual umbrellas, forming a makeshift roof and scattered propane heaters warding off the chill. The target took a seat inside. Guy continued outside, taking a table with his back to the park and a view of the target's location through the window. The day was rapidly fading, and Guy reflected on what could be happening. Another meeting, or just dinner? Either way, he knew the target had about an hour before boarding the ferry, so whatever it would be, it wouldn't take all night. A waiter approached, wearing a green apron and a cheap earpiece attached to a radio on his hip. Guy ordered a Coke, then surreptitiously scanned the other waiters and waitresses, seeing they all had the same radio set up. He forced himself to relax. It was just a marketing ploy. They probably didn't even function. The waiter brought his drink and he took a sip, surveying the crowd. Most were locals, but there were a few that stood out as tourists. French, English, maybe German. A tiny fraction still willing to test the waters of the Greek economy, even with the troubles. His eyes were tracking back to the window with his target when he saw an attractive, dirty blonde. The hair caught his eye simply because he was a man, but the face registered a different way. He had seen her before, somewhere. Or she looked like someone he had seen before. He was unsure. He stared intently, trying to place the woman, but failing. Something about her had ticked in his subconscious, and he'd learned to trust his instincts. He went to her partner, seeing a youngish male with close-cropped hair sipping water. The man wasn't a fat tourist. He was fit, and he looked like he could handle trouble, like he had handled trouble in the past. It brought a spark of alarm. Had they come in after him, or were they already here? Was he being tracked, or being foolish? The woman leaned over and kissed the man on the cheek. Guy saw him blush and relaxed. Paranoid.
Jennifer came through my earpiece loud and clear. Jackpot, I say again, jackpot, I've got Runaway. We usually gave every target we chased a nickname, and we'd taken to calling Guy Runaway for obvious reasons. I glanced at Knuckles, making sure he'd heard, and saw he had. I clicked on. Should we brace him right there? She said, I'm not sure. He's wary, like a stray cat that's looking at everything as dangerous. He just gave me and Veep a hard stare. I mean hard. If I didn't know any better, I'd say he recognized us. I looked at Knuckles, and he gave me a quick shake of his head. Impossible. He broke in, saying, Coco, no way does he know you or Veep. Are you giving off a vibe, something you can sense? Surveillance was an art as much as a science, and like ancient tribes who believed in witchcraft, we all believed you could project an aura that could burn you. Unspoken, unseen, but something there nonetheless. An aura a target could read. Jennifer said, No, no way, we're okay now. I kissed old Veep here on the cheek and got him to blush. Runaway lost interest after that. It just seemed like he could see through us somehow. But he didn't spike on blood at all, so it's not our posture. Blood was Brett Thorpe's call sign, and as an African-American, something he absolutely despised. He cut in, saying, Maybe it's because I know what I'm doing. He tended to believe his call sign should be Jason Bourne. Okay, that's not true. He didn't have an arrogant bone in his body. But he did have a sense of humor about poking anyone else on the team. Truthfully, after hearing some of his stories, maybe his call sign should be Jason Bourne. He continued saying, Pike, I think he's following someone. We ran a recce of the site, and nobody here remotely resembles the target deck. But he's definitely focused on a guy inside, an unknown. Knuckles raised an eyebrow at the words. I said, So don't brace him there? Brett said, No. Let this play out. We know he's got a ferry ticket in an hour. My recommendation is not to do anything here. He's hyper alert, and he's looking for trouble. Let him get somewhere and relax. Jennifer cut in. Break, break. Runaways up and moving.
Chapter 42. Guy ignored the couple, focusing on the target in the window, disgusted at his paranoia. He ordered a beer, pushing the Coke away. When it arrived, he downed it in three large gulps, thinking about the future. He still had two men to kill, and he was fairly certain he could find them, given the electronic tether he had with Nasser's phone. He also had the key to the safe deposit box in Athens, a box that was apparently a clearinghouse of false documents and bank accounts. And a man in a cafe. Decisions, decisions, decisions. He ordered another beer, then felt his bladder, realizing he hadn't urinated the entire night, unwilling to use the bathroom the body was in. He stood up, moving towards the entrance, and found himself unconsciously leaning to the right, vertigo making him feel as if he were falling. He grabbed a table and steadied himself, shaking his head to clear it. The sensation subsided, and he entered the cafe, following the signs to the restrooms. He reached the narrow stairwell, feeling his brain growing fuzzy. A peculiar half-drunk without the euphoria. He was close to the bottom of the stairwell when he slipped, sliding the rest of the way on his butt. The room began to shift violently, and he realized he'd been drugged. The woman outside. Should have listened to my instinct. He fought through the dizziness, swinging his hand about trying to find purchase on the rail. He glanced up and saw his waiter standing at the top of the stairs, looking down in concern. He felt a cool breeze and realized a door had opened. Another waiter pushing a keg of beer came through. He could see the twilight outside, the setting sun bouncing off of a delivery van, the engine running. Incongruously, he wondered if the van would get a ticket for parking illegally, his brain refusing purchase on his situation. The waiter with the keg bent over, and Guy held out his hand, mumbling for help. The man pulled out a pistol and pointed it at his head, saying, "Drop your weapon. I know you have one." Guy stared into the maw of the barrel, the darkness sucking him in, and a small piece of his mind clicked. A sliver of his true self awoke. He reached behind his back and withdrew the worn 6P9. Laying it on the ground, the man said, "Get up. No fighting, or you'll die right here." Guy pulled himself with the rail, forcing his brain to engage, forcing out the fog by sheer will alone. He wobbled and realized he would have one chance, and would most likely die right here. The man waved the pistol to the door, and Guy took a step, then stuttered as if he was falling forward. He was not. The man grabbed his shirt right at the collarbone, chuckling and saying, "Okay, okay, you're okay. You can walk." Guy reached up and trapped the man's hands with both of his, then fell sideways for real, using his weight to torque the man's wrist in a direction it shouldn't go. The man screamed, and Guy felt the bones snap. He ended up on top of the man, uselessly scrambling to control his weapon. The man yelled again, bringing his gun hand forward, and fired, Guy knocking the gun high, the bullet slapping into the roof. With his left hand, he grabbed the long silencer of the 6P9 and swung the pistol like a tomahawk, smashing the man in the temple. He heard another crack and realized someone else was shooting. In slow motion, his body refusing to move with any speed, he turned and saw the waiter at the top of the stairs, holding another pistol. "Team. It's a team. I'm done." The man fired again, and Guy flopped backwards, reversing the 6P9 and aiming with a two-handed grip. The barrel wobbled all over the place like a conductor working a symphony. He couldn't get a sight picture. He squeezed off a round, the bullet traveling harmlessly into space. The man took aim again, and Guy knew he was dead. He waited on the strike, then saw the waiter's knees buckle, his head snapping backwards, as if it was attached to a string. Guy blinked and pulled himself upright. It was the blonde woman, taking the man down from behind. She brought him to the ground, and he watched her hammer the waiter in the throat. She looked down at him, her face hidden by her hair, illuminated in the harsh light of the overhead lamps. And the recognition came like a thunderbolt. It was something he'd seen before, duplicating this very scene. It was the woman from the task force surveillance tape in Istanbul. The one who'd been with Decoy when he died. The one he'd watched over and over, not for her, but for him. She was task force. And she was deadly. He stumbled backwards, reaching the open door. He went through it, staggering into the street, looking for shadows to hide within.
Chapter 43. I started the car immediately, jumping through traffic to get to the cross street at the base of the park. The area was blanketed with pedestrian-only thoroughfares, but the street below the park cut through them all, where my team was currently running like hell to reach me. Knuckles worked the radio, a hodgepodge of calls that only fleetingly told us what was going on. Two men down, then three men. Nick and Brett assaulting an armed waiter, then Jennifer eliminating another waiter shooting at Guy. Then all of them sprinting like looters into the park, panting on the radio for pickup. I raced down the lane, seeing a fountain to my front, the park. I hammered the brakes, causing the car behind me to honk. I ignored him, staring up the hill. I caught movement. In between gasps for air, I heard, "Almost out. You guys staged?" I couldn't make out who the caller was, but Knuckles said, "We're in position." I scanned up the hill, and Knuckles said, there they are." Three figures broke from a tree line, skipping down the slope in a loping run. Knuckles opened the sliding doors to our minivan, and I kept my eyes up higher, looking for a follow-on force giving chase. I saw nothing. They leapt inside and I hit the gas, moving out of the kill zone and getting back into the flow of Crete traffic, away from the cloistered neighborhood streets. I let them get some adrenaline out before I began questioning, knowing they'd start talking amongst each other. Nick said, "What the fuck? Why did you smack that guy? What did you see?" Brett said, "He was keyed on Guy from the moment I entered. When Guy stood up, he started forward. Guy went inside, then I saw him put a hand on a gun." "There was no gun. I mean, there was no way you could see a gun. How did you know?" I looked in the rearview and saw Brett wink at Jennifer. He said, "Sometimes you just know. Thanks for helping out." Nick said, "You didn't give me much choice." Brett said, "Welcome to the task force. You did fine. Although, maybe you should have helped out Jen instead of me. I had no trouble." Jennifer said, "Don't do that. I was fine. If he'd have come to me, you wouldn't have been able to handle that third threat." I finally cut in. "Okay, enough of the love fest. What the hell happened?" Brett said, "Someone is hunting Guy, someone besides us, and it wasn't a bunch of Arabs. They were inside the cafe. They infiltrated the waitstaff. It was a planned ambush, and they were gunning for Guy." "Who is it?" "No idea. But it wasn't a target of opportunity. They led him there with the man who was following, led him into an ambush. If we hadn't been there, he'd be dead instead of on the run." I turned onto the main east-west road and said, "Jen, what about that? Where is he?" "He fled out the back. No way could I have followed. He had a pistol and was looking to kill. But there was something else." "What?" "He was drugged. He was staggering around. Brett's right. They knew he was coming, and they infiltrated the waitstaff with a complex plan. It wasn't the Arabs. Or if it was, they have incredible reach." I said, "Why, though? Why go to that trouble? Why not just kill him on the road? If they had that fidelity of where he was." Knuckles said what I was thinking. "Because he's on to something. They needed to take him alive for some reason, find out what he knew and who he's working with. They think he's operating with sanction." I shook my head. "Shit, that's not what I want to hear." We rode in silence for a moment, all of us tumbling the information. Finally, Knuckles said, "What's the next step? What do you want to do?" I pulled over, putting the van in park. I said, "I'm thinking we brace him on the ferry. We know he's getting on it because of the credit card purchase. How will we find him?" I turned to Jennifer. "You burned?" "I don't know." He stared at us hard before the fight, but I think it was just because he's paranoid. He didn't get a look at my face during the fight. He was too busy escaping. But he's task force. He might remember both me and Nick. "Brett." "No, I'm completely clean." "Okay, we go to the ferry." I pulled up the ferry company website on a laptop, getting an amenities list. There are only two places serving food, a restaurant inside and a fast food vendor on the deck. Sooner or later, he's got to get some food or drink. We stake out those two. "Jennifer, you mix it up a little bit. Change your hair, put on glasses or something. You'll go with Brett as cover to mix up the profile. Nick, you go alone. You get the outside deck. It's cold out, so wear a hoodie to hide. Take a corner seat and just drink coffee. Look like a hippie backpacker." Jennifer said, "What are you and Knuckles going to do?" "Sit in a room until you call. He sees either of us first, and he's liable to go lethal."
Chapter 44. Guy felt a hammering in his skull and finally awoke, disoriented in the darkness. He sensed movement, his body feeling as if it were shifting, and tensed for the vertigo. Then he remembered. He'd made it to the ferry. That's what he was feeling. He was on the ocean. He lay back in the small bunk, staring at the ceiling in the gloom, trying to collate all that had occurred. He leaned over the bed, seeing his small knapsack. He slid his hands down the rail and found the 6P9. He was safe. The movement back to his hotel, then to the ferry port, was a blur, like a blackout drunk from his younger days in the army. Only this one had deadly implications. He had vague recollections of packing, of checking out, the woman looking at him in concern, and staggering to the ferry. He'd arrived right after they allowed boarding and had managed to talk his way through the process. There were no customs or other law enforcement, the only gateway being a ticket agent and two stevedores. He'd moved inside the cavernous ship, walking by the trucks and other transport being loaded, and received his room key, a single bunk and a claustrophobically small closet. He remembered removing his shoes, then nothing. Rubbing his face, he realized he could see the ceiling. There was light coming through the small circular window. He looked at his watch and saw it was dawn. He'd been asleep for 12 hours, almost the entire journey. He felt his stomach rumble and sat up, the rapid movement bringing on a remnant of vertigo from the drug. He steadied himself, praying it wasn't something that did permanent damage. The feeling passed, and he put on his shoes. By his watch, they would be landing in less than an hour, and he had a lot of thinking to do, decisions to make. The attack at the cafe had been well planned, and it hadn't been done by a bunch of Arabs. Whoever had done it had connections in Crete, enough so to co-opt the staff and prepare an elaborate attack. It was amazing it hadn't succeeded, and had all of the hallmarks of a task force operation. But he'd been saved by the task force, the woman from Decoy's tape. Clearly they were tracking him, had somehow found him, even with his precautions. They were a threat, but it wasn't them who'd set the plan in motion. Somehow the false waiters had known he'd be in that cafe. But why had he been in that cafe? Because he'd been following a target. Someone under the control of the killers from Qatar. They'd manipulated him to arrive. But even they wouldn't be able to take over a cafe with that elaborate plot in 24 hours. No, it had to be someone local. Nikos. And that fucker would pay. One more for the target deck. He stood, putting the 6P9 in the small of his back and testing his legs, finding them strong. He left the room, moving up the two decks to the cafeteria. He reached the open space of the deck, away from the narrow gangways, stepping over folks in sleeping bags too cheap to fork over money for a cabin. He entered the cafeteria and took a quick survey, seeing families and loners all waiting to dock. He bought a pastry and a cup of coffee, wolfing down the first before touching the second. He stood at the counter and methodically went over the room, searching for danger. He found it next to a black man in the corner. A Caucasian woman sitting beside him making small talk, dark glasses on her face and a scarf over her head. She made no outward show of even acknowledging his presence, but he knew who she was. It radiated off of her like a heat from an open stove, a connection he'd found on a tape detailing a death that punctured his core. It was the woman from Decoy's tape, the one who'd saved his life. She looked nothing like she had last night, but he knew. He had no idea how, but he felt it. She was here, on the ferry, which meant the man she was talking with was a killer as well. Task force, with a skill equal to his own. He considered his options. He was on a boat that may be blanketed with task force operators. It wasn't like he could escape on the open ocean. The woman was already talking on a radio, alerting the team of his presence, of that he was sure. But she hadn't done anything against him. On the contrary, she'd saved his life, and she'd killed the fuck who'd murdered Decoy. He was sick of hiding, tired of running. He was doing what was just. It might not have started that way, but he was sure it would end in his favor. He wanted absolution, and he was looking at the only entity that could give it to him. He made his choice. He strode right up to their table, seeing the black man's eyes go wide. He raised a hand, saying, "No, don't." The man relaxed, his hand at the small of his back, waiting. Guy turned to the woman and said, "Jennifer Cahill, right?" She looked confused and said, "I'm sorry, I think you've mistaken me for someone else." He said, "No, I'm not. I've seen your work. Decoy was my friend. I'm hoping you are as well." Chapter 45. Sharif Al-Attiyah held a finger up to the Skype call and said, "Don't say another word. Shut up." He turned away from the screen, feeling the beginnings of a throbbing headache. "Tariq, get in here." He waited for his assistant to arrive, giving his son nothing to indicate how incredibly angry he was. Out of habit, he awoke early every morning, but the time was usually his own, before he began his day with the investment authority. This morning had been different, with him waking up to 3 missed calls and an urgent text message for him to Skype his son. He had, and heard nothing but disaster. Tariq entered the room, taking one look at Sharif's visage and becoming subdued. He'd seen the volcano Sharif could become, and knew whatever was happening, it was not good news. Sharif turned back to the screen and said, "Okay, idiot, continue." Hyder stumbled for words, then said, "Do you want me to repeat what I told you?" "No, you donkey. Just keep going."
"Yes, sir. Nasser is missing, and we're sure he's dead. We missed capturing the American, but we're searching Crete. Nikos has men at the airport and is combing the hotels. He has a lot of penetration, a lot of help. We'll find him soon."
Tariq's face showed confusion, and Sharif said, "My
idiot son found out that he was being tracked for his actions in Afghanistan. Instead of calling me or leveraging whatever help we could provide, he decided to use our Shahid as bait. The mission failed, and now our Syrian is compromised. His face slack, Tariq said, "What?" Spittle flying from his lips, Sharif barked. "He put our mission in jeopardy. He tried to capture the American, and all he did was expose the Syrian. Now the American is running loose." Trying to catch up without asking any more questions, Tariq said, "Is the Syrian on the ferry?" From the computer, Haider said, "Yes, yes, he wasn't harmed. Father, it was the U.S. Secretary of State who told me about the plot. I decided to intervene. It should have been easy, but he had help. Someone helped him escape." "So it's a team? An American team hunting the Syrian?" "No, no, Father, they are hunting me. Me and my friends, and they've killed two." Sharif waved that away with a hand, saying, "What does the Greek Nikos know?" "Nothing. He knows only the documents we paid for. He's used to working outside the law. He tried to capture the American in Athens when he spotted the man conducting surveillance on our meeting." Sharif exploded again. "The American was there 2 days ago? And I'm just now finding out?" Haider ducked his head on the screen, saying nothing. Tariq said, "Sir, let's focus on the problem. What's done is done." Sharif said, "How do you know the man is still on Crete?" "He was drugged. He wouldn't have had the capacity to purchase a plane ticket. We believe he's either in a hotel or passed out in an alley. We're looking." "What about a ferry?" "It left too soon. Nikos says he wouldn't be coherent enough to buy a ticket that quickly."
"What if he already had one?"
"He was following our man because we sent a message to trap him. He didn't know where the man was staying. He captured Nasser, but Nasser knew nothing of the plan. The only lead he had was the meeting we set up. There's no way he knew the Syrian was leaving. He was following the man for a reason, and the Shahid could have stayed for days."
"What was that reason? Because he wants to prevent a plot? Or because he wants to kill you?"
Haider glanced back into the room, and Sharif snapped at him. "Who's there with you?"
"Khalid."
"Bring him forward. I don't like talking to people I can't see."
Khalid sat next to Haider, looking nowhere near as timid. He said,
"Sir, it was my idea to capture the American. And it was a good idea. You would have done the same."
"Shut up! I'm not addressing you. Sit still."
Khalid showed no indication the words had any effect, but he remained silent. Sharif said,
"Son, answer the question. Is the man hunting you, or is he trying to penetrate our plans?"
Truculent, Haider said,
"Which one is worse to you? Don't trifle with me. He's after me. Khalid and me. Secretary Billings said it was because of Afghanistan, a vendetta."
Sharif nodded and said,
"Okay, so we just have to keep you alive a little longer. Make sure he's chasing you and not the Syrian. Maybe I should serve you up like you did our Shahid."
"Father,"
Khalid said, "you won't be serving me up."
He let a pause go before adding,
"Sir."
Sharif waved his hand at the screen and said,
"Don't tell me what I will or will not do. You sons of dogs have no business here anyway. Haider, what did you learn of the peace deal?"
Do you have a location in Afghanistan?
It's not in Afghanistan. It's in Oslo, Norway. But I don't know when. I have a meeting with Secretary Billings in 2 days. I should learn the timeline then.
Oslo? Did you send the Syrian to Afghanistan like I ordered?
No. He's coming here. I thought it prudent.
Sharif nodded.
Good. Good. At least you did one thing right.
Haider let slip a tiny smile, and Sharif said,
Can you continue with this man on the loose?
Yes, of course. He's on Crete, and I'm in Athens.
Okay, do so. Get control of the Syrian, meet the Secretary of State, then report back. Is that understood?
Haider said,
Yes, sir.
Sharif ended the call, with Khalid looking on in disdain. Tariq said,
That man Khalid has no respect, especially given his station.
Sharif said,
Yes, but he has more courage than my own son. I almost wish he were the one in charge.
He tapped a finger to his lip for a moment, then said,
Do you think we should continue? Do you think our Syrian remains viable?
Tariq thought for a moment, then said,
Yes, we can continue.
If the American is chasing our man, the plan might fail, but so what? All they have is a refugee that fled Libya and ended up in Crete. There's no connection between us. Let the Syrian move forward. Let the meeting go as Haider plans. There is no downside.
There is one, and we need to deal with it.
What do you mean?
Sharif looked at his trusted confidant and said,
Start scrubbing my association. Start building everything on the back of my son.
The implications sank in, and Tariq said,
Are you sure?
Yes, don't look at me that way. At one time, I was willing to give my life for the cause. Why would I not be willing to give my son's?
Chapter 46. I heard the phone buzz through a half-conscious mind, my brain making it part of the weird dream I was having involving weapons, Knuckles, and a sociopath on the loose. Knuckles slapped me and said, We're on. We'd boarded the ferry right before it left, buying 2 3-man rooms, earning me a little jab from Knuckles about how Jennifer and I always managed to get the leftovers, allowing us to sleep in the same place. He made fun of our relationship just because he could, but he was coming to grips with the new normal, meaning I was capable of making decisions despite my feelings for Jennifer, or more precisely, because of my connection to her. Anyway, it wasn't like we'd had the chance to use the damn room. The team had staked out the 2 food vendors soon after boarding, and nothing had happened for the duration of the trip. I'd become convinced we had left Guy on Crete. I came fully awake and said, Who's texting, Veep or Coco? Coco, runaway's in the room. We'd been on the damn boat for close to 12 hours, with Veep outside freezing his ass off, and Jennifer and Brett acting like the other folks who were too cheap to buy a room, hanging out in the cafeteria instead of the cattle call of the seats crammed together in the coach section. We'd relied on text messages, because we knew that Runaway would recognize the task force Bluetooth earpieces we all used. It made the contact slow, but it was better than the guy seeing the clues and fleeing. I picked up my phone. The text read, Runaway here, buying coffee. I texted back, Atmospherics? Good. Not a lot of people around. Let him take a seat. I looked at Knuckles, feeling the adrenaline, knowing that the next few steps would be crucial. I texted back, Give me a lock on when he sits down. Roger. We waited, staring at the phone, wanting a good end, wanting this decision to be one of the good ones. Like every mission, I was thrown a curveball. The phone vibrated with, He's walking to us, straight at us. I waited a moment then. When nothing else came in, I texted, "What the hell does that mean?" My phone rang with a verbal call. I looked at Knuckles and he shrugged. I answered and heard, "Pike, I'm here with Guy. He'd like to talk." I took that in and, like a high school cheerleader whispering about a date, I said, "Can he hear me?" "No. What the fuck is going on?" "Get up here, I'm with him now." We moved out, Knuckles in the lead. Going up the gangway, he said, "What's the call with this? What do you want to do?" "Same as before. We wanted to isolate him and talk. He beat us to the punch, but it's still the same game." We entered the deck and I found Jennifer at a table toward the rear, looking concerned. Brett was next to her, a little smile on his face, and his hand at the small of his back, telling me he was ready to draw if necessary. I'm not sure anything would cause his blood pressure to rise. I saw the back of Guy's head. When Jennifer focused on us, he turned around, and I was shocked at his appearance. He looked like a cancer patient, drawn and papery, like something was eating him from the inside out. I walked up with a confident swagger and said, "Hey, Guy, guess you found us out." He stood, and I saw a dislocation. A feral projection that told me he wasn't whole. A projection I'd seen before, looking in the mirror during the bad days. He was being torn apart. He said, "Hey, Pike, I'm glad it was you. I wanted to talk to you. I wanted to talk to anyone in the task force, but you're the best choice. You know what I'm doing, you understand." Not a good way to start. He continued, "I have information on a potential attack. I'm following a lead. I'm doing what's right." He was staring at me with a weird glow, and I knew he was sliding over the edge. I had no idea what he'd done, but I knew it wasn't good. All that remained was pulling him back up. I shook his hand and said, "Guy, good to see you. Kurt asked me to find you." I saw his eyes narrow, reevaluating. We sat down. He said, Yeah. I knew you'd be coming, but fuck, I never thought you'd get to me this fast." I gave him an easy smile, trying to reconcile in my mind what I was seeing in the flesh. Nobody around us could recognize it, but I was looking at disaster. The man was a caricature of his former self. I saw Knuckles' face and realized I was wrong. Some others could recognize it as well. Chapter 47. He went between Knuckles and me, ignoring Brett and Jennifer for the men he knew. He said, "I understand you want to bring me home, I get that. But did you hear what I said about a potential attack? I think we're missing something." By saying "we're," I got a handle. He believed I was with him. He believed I was in his family, which could prove all the difference. I said, "Okay, Guy, I'll hear you out. What do you have?" He pulled out a cheap digital camera and turned it on, flipping to a picture of a thin, swarthy youth of about 20 with a scrub beard, not one from the target package. He said, "This man, he's doing something against American interests, and it's tied to those fucks from Qatar, the ones who killed my brother." He told me the story of tracking one of the faces on the target package, watching the link up, then switching to the unknown. He ended with email intercept and the trail from the ferry to the cafe. The story had definite spikes of suspicious behavior, with the bank money and identification, but he'd glossed over something pretty significant. I said, "What happened to the first guy? Nasir, was it? Where is he?" I saw the weird glow again, and he said, "He's where he should be. He admitted to killing my brother." Everyone mentally flinched at the words. We'd hoped we could interdict him before he did something awful, but we'd clearly failed. Softly, barely above a whisper, I said, "What about the man in Key West?" He just looked at me. No questions in his eyes. He knew exactly what I was talking about. I said, "Guy, you can't do this. Come with us. Let me take you home." He said, "Did you even hear what I said? There's an attack being planned. This isn't about my brother anymore. Yes, it is. Come home with us and let me bring it up to the Oversight Council. This isn't the way. I saw the blossom of anger and knew I was losing. I needed to bring him in on his own volition, not forcibly. I had enough people with me to prevent any damage, but I couldn't hogtie him here, in the middle of the deck. He said, "Really? Is that what you said in Istanbul, when Decoy was killed?" "Don't make this about me." He scoffed and said, "Yeah, right, you went on a rampage killing anyone who'd been involved in that operation. You did it against orders, you did it, and now I'm the murderer?" What he said was true, and it was unsettling to hear Kurt's fears borne out by a man I'd been ordered to bring home. I said, "We stopped a nuclear device from killing thousands." He leaned forward, "And that's what I'm doing as well. You went after the Russians because they killed Decoy. I would have too. And in your path of destruction, you found a threat. I'm doing the same thing. I have done the same thing. Help me here." I glanced at Knuckles and Guy caught the look. He followed the gaze, talking to my second in command. "Don't you go all high and mighty on me too. I know what happened. I know what you asked Pike to do. You begged him to kill every one of those sorry sons of bitches involved in Decoy's death." He turned to me, the heat radiating out of his eyes. "And you did." I said, "Guy, don't twist this into situational ethics. That mission has nothing in common with what you're doing. The two are not the same, and you can't justify the one by talking about the other. Don't even go there." He leaned back into the cushions of his chair. He studied me for a moment, then said, "So that's how it is. You kill whenever it suits you. But you're still on a leash for fucks who have no idea what we do. They say jump and you do." "What the hell are you talking about? You can't go around killing just because you think it's right. But it's okay when you do it." "That's not what I mean. I listen to the council. They exist for a reason. It's not about a vendetta. It's about national security." The words sounded hollow even before they left my mouth. He was right about everything he'd said, and my actions in Istanbul were proving Kurt correct on the dangers of the task force. He said, "Think about it. We get Omega authority from the council and it's game on. Our consciences salved by some fat fuck with a pen. How many times have you been denied Omega because of some overarching political bullshit? Not because the target wasn't worthy. So by a stroke of a pen, we can take a guy out. But without that blessing, we're murderers, based on some political crap that has nothing to do with the target. How is that right?" I felt the gap growing between us, his earlier hope at seeing me slipping away. I tried to stop the slide. "I hear you, I really do. But we live in a land of laws. We can't just decide when and what law we're going to follow, and sometimes that political crap proves more important. It's imperfect, but it's the best system in the world." The statement fell flat on him. I tried again. "Tell me about the target you found. What do you have for an anchor? Maybe I can get the Oversight Council to let me loose on it." He said nothing for a moment, and I saw I'd lost. When he did speak, it was exactly what I didn't want to hear. "Pike, I respect you, but we both know what you say isn't true. They won't let you chase it. Not with me running loose, and I'm not coming in until the mission is done. If I give you the information, all I'm doing is giving you the ability to interdict me." The people around us began to rise, and I realized we had docked. I was running out of time. Guy stood up. He looked at Jennifer and said, "Thank you for what you did for Decoy." He came back to me. "And thank you for hunting down the rest of the vermin that killed him. I'm going to do the same for my brother, for his men." I grabbed his arm and he let me. He said, "Are you going to take me down right here? How is that going to be explained when I start screaming about top secret commandos out to kill me? Do you think the police will just let us go without any answers?" I said, "You wouldn't. You aren't that far gone." He pulled his arm away and said, "I will, because I haven't lost view of what's right." I remained seated, wondering how I'd let this get out of control. I said, "You can't continue. I know the name you're using. We'll find you. Do you think Sean Parnell would approve of you making him a murderer?" He paused for a moment, then shouldered his pack and said, I'm going to walk right off this ferry. It goes without saying that if I see you or this team again, I'll know why you're here. I'll start shooting and consider it self-defense. Knuckles spoke for the first time, saying, Decoy wouldn't want this. You're spitting on his legacy, what he believed in. He said, not true. Decoy would have done the same if the roles had been reversed and you'd been murdered. And I know my brother doesn't mind what I'm doing now. He entered the flow of people leaving the ferry, and we simply sat, watching him disappear into the crowd of people.
Chapter 48. Perched on a couch inside the Oval Office, Kurt Hale waited patiently for President Warren to finish toying with his iPad. To his left, George Wolfe provided some much-needed moral support. Across from him sat Alexander Palmer, the National Security Advisor, and an unknown vote in the room. Nobody else was present. No other Oversight Council personnel had been invited, and Kurt intended to use that to his advantage. He was here ostensibly to discuss manning issues, and thus the full council wasn't necessary. But he also had some explosive information that he wanted to present one-on-one to the president. Getting a read on his mindset before throwing the stinking carcass onto the briefing table for the full Oversight Council. It was not how the council was designed to be used, and in fact was counter to the charter under which the task force operated. But Kurt had done it in the past for sensitive operations, and this one was most definitely sensitive. The president finally looked up and said, "Where were we? You said you had a solution for the Blaine dilemma. You have someone else in mind?" Kurt glanced at George, then said, "No, sir. I want to keep Blaine. I want him to go ahead and SERB out, as if he was forced to retire, then hire him on as a contractor." Palmer said, "I thought you'd already discarded that idea. We're going backwards here. When we last spoke, we agreed you'd cull the records and find someone else for Omega Command. A fresh body, someone new." In presenting the arguments to keep Blaine on active duty and inside the task force, Kurt had basically sabotaged his current plan. When it had become clear that there was no good way to retain Blaine without an inquiry into what he'd been doing and exposure of task force operations, in effect, giving up the organization to prove that he wasn't just a homesteading staff officer at the Pentagon coasting through his career, Kurt had agreed to let him go. Then he'd thought about Pike's words in the restaurant. After multiple consultations with George Wolfe, he'd decided it was, while not perfect, the best solution available. Kurt said, "I know, sir. But I've thought about it, and I don't think we should attempt to train up another person for the Omega operations. It's the crux of the task force mission, and the greatest single point of failure. We need someone on the X who understands both the tactical and strategic dimensions of a hit. Someone who knows when to proceed and when to quit, and that's Blaine. He's learned too much to simply let him go. We talked about hiring him as a contractor just to keep his expertise, but that very expertise is wasted sitting at headquarters." President Warren said, "I thought you were concerned about precedent, about opening the portals of the task force too wide. You have a cut line of who is eligible to even try out for the task force. By doing this, you're potentially abusing your own rules. What's to say years from now, when you and I are both gone, the commander decides to hire someone based on friendship? Someone not from the DOD Special Mission Unit or CIA paramilitary world?" "Sir, that's a risk, I know. But I think it's a greater risk to replace him. We aren't a plug-and-play unit like an infantry command. His skills were not learned at Ranger School or Command and General Staff College. I'm actually looking at the long-term health of the task force. Palmer said, or you're just kicking the can down the road. President Warren said, how would it work? How can you have a civilian leading active duty members? It works because of his reputation. It's not like he wears a uniform on the job with his rank. The men listen to him because of who he is, not because of his title. I don't know if I want to start outsourcing to contractors. Sir, you already do, with Pike Logan. He's a civilian too, but he's in charge of a team of active duty guys. President Warren imperceptibly nodded, thinking through the ramifications, and Kurt pressed. Sir, technically, you're a civilian. But you're also the commander-in-chief. Vice President Hannister is running for your job. He knows the terrain, but you have to admit that he's going to need all the experience he can get if he wins. President Warren had been elected on a national security platform and had brought Philip Hannister to the ticket because of his economic expertise and domestic experience as an effort to round out the campaign. Palmer laughed and said, let's not get ahead of ourselves here. The election is months away. Wolf spoke for the first time. It's not that far off, and we need to plan for the future, whatever that future may be. President Warren said, okay, you guys, we'll take a look at it. We've got time to sort this out. He stood, indicating the meeting was over. Kurt rose as well and said, sir, I've got one other thing to talk about.
What is it?
Pike's located Guy George. And it's bad. President Warren said, how bad? You might want to sit back down. He did so, and Kurt laid out everything he knew, detailing Guy's killing spree in Key West and Crete, and the attempt to capture or kill him in the restaurant, ending with the confrontation on the ferry. Palmer was stunned, his mouth slightly open. He found his voice and said, so Pike had a chance to bring him in and didn't? After he learned about the killings? It's not that simple. Pike couldn't have taken him down on the ferry in front of the crew and passengers from a foreign country. Guy threatened task force exposure. Pike did the correct thing here. Maybe he picked a wrong time to approach. Hell, earlier you were using him as an example of a civilian with needed experience. I would have thought Pike would know better. Kurt started to answer, and President Warren interrupted with a question. Would Guy do that? Expose the task force? Kurt said, I don't know, honestly. He told Pike he would, but the strange thing is Pike didn't go to him initially. Guy sought out the task force on his own. He recognized Jennifer from that decoy tape that's floating around and walked right up to her. He introduced himself and stated he hoped she was a friend. Pike thinks he was looking for help, looking for a way out. At first, he was friendly and it looked like it would be a good ending. Then he changed. It's like he's bouncing between the good and the bad. I just don't know what he's capable of. Palmer said, Jesus Christ. So we have a lunatic on the loose? Billings was right? Kurt said, I'm not sure I'd call him a lunatic just yet. There's more to this than meets the eye. He told Pike he was onto a plot. He was following a guy on the ferry, someone who'd met the second man he killed and received identification and money. He told Pike he'd quit once he'd solved the problem. President Warren said, and I'm supposed to take what he says at face value? An unstable, trained killer who's murdering members of the Cotter government? Sir,
Pike believes he's really stumbled onto something. Believes that in his quest for revenge, he actually found something bad. And there's enough smoke out there to warrant further exploration. No matter what Secretary Billings says, we know for a fact that the one he killed in Key West and the one that Billings is in love with in Greece both bear a striking resemblance to the men on his brother's target package. We don't know which one he killed in Crete, but Guy said he admitted to being in Afghanistan, admitted to killing his brother. On top of that, someone besides us tried to capture Guy. Someone with a motive and real skill. I know we have other equities in play here, but the problems in Greece shouldn't supersede the evidence of wrongdoing. We just can't walk away. They've killed Americans and might be planning to kill more. President Warren pursed his lips and glanced at Palmer. Palmer shrugged, then said, "Tell him. Can't hurt anything." This ends Disc 6.